from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
I think that the real thing that we're seeing right now is the dominance of the administrative and the judicial over the others. And among the three branches, the dominance of the judicial. And that's something that both sides have accepted.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. And that's Dr. Kevin Porteous, Professor of Politics and Director of American Studies at Hillsdale College. We talk at length with Dr. Porteous today about the separation of powers in our federal government. Dr. Porteous, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is how our government was set up in the Constitution. Of course, the country had a document before that, the Articles of Confederation, that failed. What did our founders learn from the Articles of Confederation that led them to this idea of the separation of powers?
Well, after independence and the colonists, now the new Americans, were left to write or rewrite their colonial constitutions as new state constitutions, and then they needed a new government at the national level if we're going to be one people, they put into practice a good deal of what they had learned in their colonial experience. And the colonial experience was that governors, the executive branch, they were royally appointed. Mm-hmm. That is, they're not representative of the people. And so those are the people, the executive branch, that's the one we need to guard against. They learn from the British system, monarchy, that can be tyrannical. We need to watch out for the executive. But at the same time that they had royally appointed governors, they also had locally elected legislatures. And so what they learned there was that legislatures were the bulwark of the people's rights. This is where self-government is to be found. And so when they had the opportunity to write their own state constitutions and to write what became the Articles of Confederation, they put that into practice. And so they designed systems where you didn't just have the legislature as the leading institution, you had the legislature as the supreme institution. Mm-hmm. That was where the power lay. At the state level, that meant hamstringing state governors. So you'd saddle them with councils that they didn't elect and couldn't control. You would take away their veto power. You would create parallel institutions like boards of war and use those to take, for instance, the commander-in-chief power away from state governors. At the federal level, in the Articles of Confederation, this manifested itself as the absence of an executive altogether. The only institution that was created by the Articles of Confederation was Congress, the Confederation Congress. And what they learned during that period was, we need effective enforcement of the laws.
How does the separation of powers, in what ways does the separation of powers in the way that it's designed in the Constitution in our government, take into account human nature?
I think that human nature for the founders is one of the critical things that you have to get right in order to get government right. There are, I think, three things. You have to have good principles, mm-hmm. right? And you have to have a good knowledge of the particular circumstances on the ground when you're making constitutions, when you're making policy. What are the issues? What are the problems? The other thing you have to have a handle on is human nature. And they believed, and this is in marked contrast, for instance, to, say, the progressives, they believed that human nature was, to put it glibly, mixed and fixed, which is to say there's both good and bad in human nature, justice and injustice, and that's not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Madison says in Federalist 10 that the latent causes of faction are sown in the nature of man. We can't get rid of them. All we can do is deal with them. So the way the separation of powers does that is to kind of take human nature and accept it for what it is. We can't change it. We can't annihilate the bad. We can't annihilate selfishness, ambition, right? The various modern revolutionaries, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, they try and transform man. The framers of the Constitution, the founding fathers, never do that. They accept man for what he is and try and make it work. So what they do is they say, okay, ambitious people are going to want power. Mm-hmm. Let's give them power, but let's make their power dependent on the Constitution, and let's give the other institutions the ability to check that institution, that officer, so that he can't gather into himself all of the power of the government, which Madison says in Federalist 47, that's tyranny, all the power in one place. So they accept human nature for what it is, and they try and channel it through the Constitution.
So we hear this phrase very often, that the United States has three co-equal branches of government. Is that actually true? Is that the way that they were set up to be, three co-equal branches of government?
Yes, I think that's correct. Now, remember that in the colonial period, they had learned to fear executive encroachment.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they wrote the Constitution, Madison says, now we are learning that legislative encroachment is a problem. And Madison says in Federalist 48 that what we learn from this is that wherever the real power is, that's the danger. And so in a monarchy, obviously that's the monarch, that's the executive. In a republic, that's going to be an elected legislature. But it's possible that any one of these branches could become dominant in a way that's problematic. So what do? Well, they recognize that in a republic, the legislature is the most dangerous because it has the support of the people, it has the power of the purse, it has the power to make policy. The executive and the judiciary, they can only enforce and adjudicate the laws that Congress has passed. At least this is the understanding that prevailed before the rise of the modern state. And so what did they do with Congress? Well, it's noteworthy that Congress is the only institution that got split in two. And they say that one of the reasons that they did that is because they recognized the danger that's inherent in a republic and a legislature and the need to split that up. Mm-hmm. So in other words, they took action to pull the legislature down to a level of equality with the other branches, and at the same time, they tried to fortify the executive by making him a unitary institution, by giving him a veto. They tried to fortify the executive with the power to resist the encroachments of the legislature. So yeah, they really did think that these were supposed to be co-equal branches with no one predominating.
What kind of a balance do you see today between the legislative, the judicial, and the executive branch?
I think this idea is of understanding the way the balance is or is not today is massively important because we tend to focus on what government does.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, the constitutionality of legislation, whether or not it's good policy. And we don't, consequently, pay enough attention to how those policies are made, how the system works, because frankly, it can be pretty boring. And look, I mean, somebody once said that if you're arguing process, you're losing the argument. But process matters. A congressman from here in Michigan, David Bonnier, I believe, said, look, you put any piece of legislation forward that you want, and you have as big a majority as you want. You let me write the rules, and I will win every time. You let me write the procedural rules. So process matters. Structure matters, right? The regime, the arrangements, they matter. And I think what you see, if you look at our system, is that it's out of balance in all sorts of ways,
mm-hmm.
right? So in one sense, Congress doesn't legislate anymore. They leave that to administrative agencies. So they've abdicated a core responsibility. In terms of policy formulation, we've elevated the president in problematic ways, consistent, by the way, with progressive ideology on what the president's supposed to do. But I think that the real thing that we're seeing right now, right, is the dominance of the administrative and the judicial over the others. And among the three branches, the dominance of the judicial. And that's something that both sides have accepted. When George W. Bush signed the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act in 2002, he said, there are parts of this bill that I think are unconstitutional, but that's for the courts to decide. And of course, the founders, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, are losing their minds over this. They're just, no. You are a constitutional officer. It is your obligation to interpret the Constitution in the course of carrying out your constitutional responsibilities.
Dr. Kevin Porteous, Professor of Politics and Director of American Studies here at Hillsdale College. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, we talk with Naomi Schaefer Wiley, author of the new book, No Way to Treat a Child, How the Foster Care System, Family Courts, and Racial Activists Are Wrecking Young Lives. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To connect with Hillsdale College, if you're an alumni, friend of the college, or prospective student, head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Naomi Schaefer Riley, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, also Senior Fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, author of six books, including the new one, No Way to Treat a Child, How the Foster Care System, Family Courts, and Racial Activists Are Wrecking Young Lives. Naomi, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So tell us a bit about this country's foster care system. Would you describe it as broken?
I would definitely describe it as broken. Just to sort of give readers like a sense of what the foster care, the child welfare system more broadly is. So there are about 3 million calls that come in every year reporting child maltreatment, either abuse or neglect or both. About 700 or 800,000 of those are investigated and substantiated, meaning that we can tell that something is definitely going wrong in those families. There are about 440,000 children who are in the foster care system, meaning that the risk to them of staying with their family was so great that we decided we had to remove them from that home. So that's kind of a snapshot at any one point in time. But during the course of a year, about 600,000 children will be in foster care over the course of a year. And so I would say it's broken mostly because, amazingly, the child welfare system seems to revolve much more around the desires and the sensibilities of adults than the best interests of children.
Do you think that many Americans might have some misconceptions about how this whole process works, how the foster system is structured, and how it carries out its duties?
I definitely think they have misconceptions about what the child welfare system is and how it carries out its duties. So the first misconception, I think, is a lot of people misunderstand what we mean when we say child neglect. So a lot of states, include in their neglect statutes, for instance, things where the parent is not the one directly responsible for abusing a child, but if, say, you have left your child in the care of known abusers, you will be charged with neglect. Neglect is also something that is quite dangerous, too, even if it doesn't involve intentional physical harm. Neglect is something that is very dangerous, especially for young children, children, say, under the age of 5 or 3, who really cannot go get help for themselves if something goes wrong. And the thing that's usually going wrong in those homes, frankly, is substance abuse. The drug crisis in this country is driving our child welfare crisis. Most of the families that I spoke with for this book and most of the cases that I studied in the research here really involve substance abuse and or mental illness, which are often co-occurring. So I think that's one great misconception is the idea that child neglect is not something that's serious and we don't need to take it as seriously as actual physical abuse. I think another thing that people misunderstand is the kids in foster care are actually a pretty small portion of the kids who are affected by the child welfare system. The vast majority of cases, those kids are left in those homes, and then we offer parents services, anger management, parenting classes, other things in order to try to get them to rehabilitate or reform their behavior. So not every child who we've found has been maltreated will then get removed from a home. So I think those are two of the biggest misconceptions.
You write a chapter in the book about sacrificing child safety for family unity. What's the logic behind that, and how is that harming our children?
In the last, number of years, we've come to the conclusion that family preservation and family reunification, if children have to be removed, should be the driving constant goal of the child welfare system. And so, obviously, who could object to the idea that a child belongs with their parents? Certainly not listeners to the Hillsdale's radio. And so I think that there's a lot of, obviously, sympathy for that position. The problem is that these are families where children are really at risk, and we've decided that we should take those risks because we feel very sorry for the adults involved. And there is much reason, by the way, to feel sorry for them. Many of them have experienced extreme poverty, job loss, incarceration, racism. Many of them have even been in the foster care system themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, do we make decisions based on those adult needs and desires to have their children in their home, or do we make decisions based on whether a child is safe in that home? And unfortunately, I think more and more we're making decisions basically saying, no, the most important thing is keeping a family together. There was just an amazing story out of Wisconsin where it turns out that caseworkers who do decide to remove children from homes are actually now being forced to apologize publicly for doing so. So these are people who've been hired to assess a risk to a family, and we're sort of saying to them, you've done something wrong even if you determine that you have to remove this child from this home. One of the main reasons, by the way, that we are really, you know, on this family preservation kick right now at all costs, is because we think that the foster care system and the child welfare system are disproportionately affecting black families. And we think that it's especially important that we keep black families together at all costs and not separate their children from the parents. Unfortunately, you know, there's a reason that the foster care system and the child welfare system actually have a disparate effect on black families, which is that child maltreatment actually is not distributed evenly across the country. And black children are actually three times more likely to die from maltreatment in this country, tragically, than white children are.
Final question for Naomi Schaefer-Riley. The new book is No Way to Treat a Child. What, if any, are some immediate fixes that perhaps even literally tomorrow with a stroke of a pen could be enacted to try to address the foster care problems?
Well, amazingly, I mean, we actually have two really important pieces of legislation that were passed during the 1990s with bipartisan support. And I think what we need to do is actually start enforcing those two pieces of legislation. The first one is the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which says if a child has been in the foster care system for 15 of the last 22 months, we need to start moving as states to terminate parental rights. And that law was put in place because children were languishing in the foster care system for years at a time. The average stay for a child in foster care in New York State, for instance, is 30 months. And so we are flouting these laws regularly. And the way the court system and the way these agencies work is, again, they're operating on an adult timeline, not a child's timeline. You know, you have cases where they'll say, oh, you know, come back in 6 months and see us and we'll decide this case. And you're dealing with a three-year-old. That's a huge portion of a three-year-old's life. So enforcing the laws that are already on the books. The other really important law is the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act, which, again, also passed in the 1990s. It bars discrimination, racial discrimination, when you're placing a child in foster care or placing them for adoption. And it says what matters most is that a child be placed in a safe, stable, and loving home, not that a child's skin color match the skin color of the adults who are caring for them, which I think is obviously a very reasonable point of view, but I will tell you it is not uncommon at all to hear people talking in court, to hear child caseworkers talking about how matching the skin color is the most important thing. I think it's outrageous, and I think since the law was passed, tens of thousands more black children have been able to find those safe, stable, loving homes. And the idea that there are people out there who want to overturn that law now, I think should really upset most people. And we should be working as hard as possible to enforce that law.
Naomi Schaefer-Riley, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Senior Fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, author of the brand new book, No Way to Treat a Child, How the Foster Care System, Family Courts, and Racial Activists Are Wrecking Young Lives. Naomi, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, we're joined by Mark Meyer, lecturer in English here at Hillsdale, about the history of the book. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Turtle Bay's fall plant sale has been extended now through the end of the year. Don't miss this chance to save big during this key season for planting perennials. The nurseries open Wednesday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
Black Bear Diner is really spicing things up for the fall. Their classic homemade chili is back by popular demand. Grab a cup, bowl, or have it in their new chili cheeseburger. They've also added Frank's Red Hot Buffalo Wing Sauce to your choice of condiments. Spice it up at Black Bear Diner. Stop by 2605 Hilltop Drive right here in Reading, or learn more at blackbeardiner.com.
Black Bear Diner.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
Deco Manufacturing Company presents How People Make Things at Turtle Bay now through January 9th. Explore this new and interactive exhibit where kids can learn firsthand about the tools and processes used to make objects that we see and use every day. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We say hello and welcome to our brand new affiliate, News Radio WTTV, 105.7 FM, 1490 AM in Vero Beach, Florida. Thank you for tuning in to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Joined now by Mark Meyer, Assistant to the Provost, Lecturer in English here at Hillsdale College. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I read with interest of this class that you taught last term here at Hillsdale called History of the Book. Why teach a class on the history of the book?
Well, it's something that has always been an interest of mine. I am in a former life, I was a librarian, and so
I worked in a library too during high school.
Oh,
so
nice.
we can talk later about stories.
Very nice. I've always loved books and been interested in books and been somewhat of a collector of books, and so this subject is near and dear to my heart. But one of the things that convinced me that I thought it might be worth pursuing as a college class is that as we kind of live in this digital world in which we're surrounded by screens and we're forever being told about the future, the paperless world and the paperless office and the paperless classroom, that it might be a good opportunity to think about how we've interacted with the printed book for the last 560 years and what sorts of things are going to change moving forward. And so it seemed like the perfect sort of opportunity for students to kind of pause and reflect and see if what the future holds is, you know, how is that going to work for them and how they interact with actual books. So
you were alluding to this, but we read in so many forms, and even in printed forms, magazines, newspapers, books certainly, and now digitally with computer screens and Kindles and phones and tablets. What makes a book different?
That's a really good question. I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to teach the class, was to think about that question. Because I am not while I'm a great lover of the printed book and collect books, I also, you know, do a lot of digital reading. Mm-hmm. I have a Kindle. I use it almost daily, and I've noticed over time my own reading habits kind of changing with the advent of digital books. And so I wanted to kind of think about that question and realize, you know, the fact of the matter is, reading a book is different from reading a magazine, which is different from reading a text message on the phone, which is different from, you know, any other type of reading that you can do. And I think that the temptation is to just kind of lump them all together.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is there are certain things that printed books can do that they've been doing very well for a very long time that digital books can't do. Some of that is based on technology and the advancements of technology, but some of it is just fairly simple. So, for example, it's really funny that actually Andrew Ferguson just recently published an article in The Atlantic about reading a print newspaper and the advantages of, you know, reading print over reading digitally. And I very much appreciate what he had to say. I have found with my own reading that if I am reading for pleasure, if I'm reading a novel, reading on a Kindle is, you know, it works because it really is, you know, the sort of experience where you start the beginning and you work your way through the end of a story and you're not needing to jump around or you know, take careful notes. And even though there is the ability to do that in a Kindle and there are different ways that you can manage that, reading in a printed book is just easier for that purpose. It's easier to kind of remember where you are in the book and, you know, make notes in the margins and to, you know, even from a memory standpoint, I find that if I have to go back and look something up, I can usually remember physically where it was located. And so for purposes of study, print books work really well. In digital books, I think less well. It's not an insurmountable problem, but it makes a difference, I think.
How have books changed, though, through the centuries?
It's interesting. You know, the reality is that the book itself hasn't changed that significantly. I think the techniques and the technologies involved in producing books has changed. But if you look at a 15th century book, which is in the Gutenberg era, it looks remarkably a lot like a 21st century book.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, again, materials change. We're not printing books on vellum and really not using much leather to speak of anymore.
except for Ron Burgundy.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But it is remarkably a stable item. In fact, many have kind of speculated that in some ways the printed book is the perfect invention. I mean, we've been using it for 500 years. It doesn't really appear to be going away. People are continually using it. But in this day and age with a digital book, there are things that are now possible that would have been unimaginable to Gutenberg and his companions. Obviously, the multimedia component of books that you couldn't have done, even 20 years ago, perhaps. Although I remember when I was in elementary school when the Encyclopedia Encarta came out, and you could read an article about FDR and then push a link and you could hear him give a speech or watch a short video. That was very exciting at the time, and that still many people still like that today. Although we're bombarded with so many images and video clips when we're online that I still think that there's something to be gained by having just the words in front of you and all the distractions left to the side.
Are we missing out on something with the demise of physical bookstores? I was talking to a student the other day and had to explain what Borders was, essentially. Do you think we're missing? Do you think we might see them return? Even, I guess, Amazon is kind of opening up these bookstores in places now, too, where people can go in and actually look and find things they might not know they want.
It's interesting. You know, there's a lot that's been said about that, and I don't have hard data, memorized, but I actually think in some ways the bookstore is making a bit of a comeback right now. I was thinking just in my own neighborhood here in Michigan. When I moved to Michigan in 2004, many of the bookstores that I used to regularly haunt as a student in Ann Arbor were closing left and right, and that we were living in the world of Borders and Barnes and Noble, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back there today, you'll see there are stores popping up left and right. Now that's in a college town, so that's not probably representative of every town. But I think I think bookstores are finding out that there are ways that they can operate that, you know, they're not directly competing with Amazon. They're doing things that Amazon can't do or doesn't have an interest in doing. So, for example, they're hosting readings of authors so you can go and get a book signed. They're having more specialized kind of curated collections so that, you know, if you're somebody that walks in and you can browse and find something you didn't even know you were looking for, whereas Amazon kind of relies on you knowing what you want
right.
and typing it in and going.
Mark Meyer with us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. You mentioned this right at the top of the conversation, conversations about, you know, a book-free future. Everything mm-hmm. is digital. You'll find what you need either on your phone. Is that a realistic thing? Are we moving that direction? Or, I guess an ancillary question is, can we trust digital storage?
Well, I think there's two different ways to approach that question. I think we are moving in that direction, although I don't think we'll ever, at least not in our lifetime, get there. Because I think that is the trend. It's interesting to think about it. The trust question is actually the harder one to answer.
Yeah.
Because I just had this experience. I was in Chicago for a conference this past weekend, and I snuck away at one point in time to go to the Newberry Library, which is a great institution there in Chicago. And I spent, you know, an hour with a colleague looking through a 16th century edition of Sir Thomas More's English Works. 1557, it looks like it could have been produced last week. I worry myself about the extent to which most of my personal work right now or my professional work is tied up in email.
Mm-hmm.
And when I leave the college, or if I ever have to leave the college for any reasons, I don't really know what, you know, certainly can't print out all those emails and pass them on to a successor.
Right.
So there are problems that we kind of are lulled into this idea that digital equals permanent, but I don't think we're there yet. And maybe we will. Maybe someday they'll figure out a way to solve that. But most of the technology is kind of developed by, you know, proprietary interests. And when they go out of business, then you have to have somebody come in and you know, figure out a way to work with that file format. And that presents all kinds of other issues.
Mark Meyer, assistant to the provost and lecturer in English here at Hillsdale College and that class History of the Book, which we discussed. Mark, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, to mark Justice Clarence Thomas's 30th year on the Supreme Court, we talk with Myron Magnet, who wrote a fantastic book a couple of years ago, Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Have you been putting off getting your colonoscopy due to COVID restrictions? Well, there's no better time than now. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, colorectal cancer screenings have declined by 86%, and as a result, up to 10,000 more deaths are projected over the next decade. With early detection, colon cancer has a 90% survival rate, and it may even be preventable with a colonoscopy. At Reading Endoscopy Center, our number one priority is the health and safety of our patients, and our center has always been committed to maintaining strict infection control and prevention protocols. Schedule your colonoscopy today by calling us at 530-246-7000 or visiting readingendoscopy.com. Visit readingendoscopy.com.
Take a stroll down Memory Lane at Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage. Whether you're looking for tools from the past, vintage clothing, collectibles, jewelry, or something that just reminds you of the good old days, you can find it at Memory Lane. Those special shabby chic and vintage style items are seen in every nook and cranny. So what are you waiting for? Sure, you can check out their Facebook page, but it's a lot more fun to explore the past and find your treasure. 1665 Pine Street in Reading, Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wayne Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill we all have to pay? The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
From the Pacific Justice Institute, this is The Legal Edge.
A pastor journalist in Spokane, Washington, simply sought to interview demonstrators and observe the drag queen story hour and was threatened with arrest. Well, PJI's chief counsel, Kevin Snyder, presented oral arguments for this pastor all the way to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
We rely on your generous support to continue to provide justice for all. Learn more at pji.org.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. This month marks 30 years that Justice Clarence Thomas has been on the U.S. Supreme Court bench. To mark the occasion, we talk with Myron Magnet, editor-at-large at City Journal, also author of the fantastic book, Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. Myron, thanks so much for joining us.
Such a pleasure to be with you. I'm such a huge fan of Hillsdale College, and of course, I like your show.
Well, thank you, and we are a big fan of you as well and the book. What do you mean by that phrase, and how was it lost?
Well, okay, what we lost was that Constitution that the framers gave us in 1787, perfected by the Bill of Rights, the Civil War amendments, and the 19th Amendment giving women the vote. How did we lose it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because people thought they could do better. There were a number of ways, but one is Woodrow Wilson decided this was an antique idea and that things were moving so fast to become modern that we needed a constitution that was a living Darwinian constitution, kept up with changing conditions, so that we should have the Supreme Court sitting as a permanent constitutional convention making up laws. And furthermore, since he was a big admirer of Frederick the Great's enlightened despotism, believe it or not, he believed we should have this administrative army, basically, of experts, highly educated. He was our first professor president, after all. And they would, knowing better than everybody else, they would make rules for people to live properly in this modern society that we had. The trouble with it is that's not self-government. And that's what Clarence Thomas hates. He is opposed to the idea that we should have rulers, and he is opposed to the idea, as you can see in a whole string of 2015 opinions of his, of an administrative state on the Woodrow Wilson model, supersized by FDR, that makes laws like a legislature, that carries them out like an executive, and that adjudicates and punishes infractions of them like a judiciary. No constitutional foundation for that, no separation of powers whatsoever, no checks and balances. So, you know, I mean, I can give you examples of the tyranny that results.
Why the decision to sort of frame this argument about the lost Constitution around this one man, the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas?
Oh, I think he's a hero, Scott. I think that because we lost this Constitution, in part because the Supreme Court actively participated in it and then participated in it because FDR put a gun to its head, you really need a justice with the courage to say, hang on, we don't sit still if the people's elected representatives pass a law that the Constitution doesn't allow. We overturn it. So why should we be any more sensitive and respectful toward the errors of our predecessors if previous courts have made mistakes and declared that something is constitutional that really is inconsistent with our framework? Overturn it. Overturn that doctrine of stare decisis, of precedent. Clarence Thomas is the most absolute defender of the idea of having the Constitution as the ultimate authority much more final than any kind of court precedent that that you can name. So he's our hero on this one, and he's perfectly happy to be a minority of one, because he's kind of laying out a blueprint for future courts to follow as they come to cases where they can reconsider some of these precedents.
Myron, it's a really well-written book, from Clarence Thomas's bio early on to late in the book. When you begin to dig into his decisions, you mentioned, I think, 2,100 or so. You don't talk about them all, but quite a few. I want to perhaps hit a few here. One you call his magnum opus so far, and that is his concurrence in the McDonald v. Chicago case, a Second Amendment case. What is it about that opinion that so appeals to you and sort of speaks to Justice Thomas?
Well, it's a wonderful history lesson. I mean, you know, it's reading it is like reading a novel. What he says is, hang on, the court has said that the citizens of Chicago can keep gun in their houses because of a doctrine called substantive due process, which is a hokey smoke and mirrors invention of the court. The court invented it because the Supreme Court, in a decision of 1873 and another one of 1876, gutted the 14th Amendment's application of Bill of Rights protections to freed slaves. And they gutted it, heaven only knows why, but they, you know, it's hard to tell from reading both the opinions and the dissents, but they gutted it. And Justice Thomas says, hey, this is personal to me. He said, I grew up under segregation. He said, there were parks I couldn't walk in, drinking fountains I couldn't use. And all of this is because the Supreme Court in the 1870s did away with this protection and allowed Jim Crow to flourish in the South for almost 100 years. He describes, you know, the history of KKK terrorism and related groups. He describes the kind of massacres that took place in the Reconstruction period to make Reconstruction fail. And he says, you know, here is a tragic history which is enshrined in these two decisions of the 1870s. And it's almost painful to him that his own court had done something so horrible mm-hmm. to an achievement that was paid for with the blood of almost 400,000 Union soldiers who died to set men free.
Myron, you describe Clarence Thomas in the book as essentially a free First Amendment absolutist. With the attacks that we see both on a personal speech side and a political speech side in recent years, is that going to be more important here in the next decade or so?
Well, we certainly are living in an era of free speech assaults in the universities, and we've seen now, at least since the 1960s, that what starts on the universities, in the universities, ends up making its way all through the culture. So I am afraid that now that we have a concept of hate speech in the universities, we're going to end up with ordinances that say, well, you can't, you know, and I mean, you can list all the victim groups that you're not supposed to talk about. Yes, I think it's going to be very, very important in that respect. But the other respect in which it's so important, Scott, is that there's a kind of piety that we have about campaign finance reform, as if there's something squeaky clean mm-hmm. about campaign finance reform. That's baloney, actually. One of the things that Madison was very clear about was that the danger in a democracy was the tyranny of the majority. And what he meant by that is that the unpropertied many would gang up on the propertied few and dispossess them of their wealth. And so from the point of view of the architect of the Constitution, it is very important that property should have a voice. So all of campaign finance is predicated on the assumption somehow that voices have to be equalized, that because the rich, because corporations especially, can buy plenty of advertising, there's something unfair about that. There's nothing unfair about that. In fact, all they are doing is putting forth their opinion about why this candidate is good or this policy is good. And Clarence Thomas's view is the whole point of the First Amendment is to give an educated electorate the opportunity to hear all arguments for what policies and personnel are best, mm-hmm. so that they can make a sensible judgment about it.
Myron Magnet, the book Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution, as we mark, as we celebrate 30 years of Justice Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court bench. Myron, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Such a pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Kevin Porteous from Hillsdale's Politics Department, talking about the importance of the separation of powers in our government. Naomi Schaefer Riley talked about her new book, No Way to Treat a Child. Mark Meyer on the history of the book. And finally, in celebration of Clarence Thomas's 30 years as a justice at the U.S. Supreme Court, we talk with Myron Magnet, author of the book Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews, including Naomi Schaefer Riley this week, or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. The assistant producer of the show is Nate Esbenshade. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com. Join Sue McClain weekday mornings from 6 to 7 for the Sue McClain News Hour, where you'll hear the up-to-the-minute local news, national and international news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Followed by Free Fire Radio from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, equal opportunity critics. From noon to 3, learn how to get out of debt with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal, local history, North State Now, and unsung heroes of our area. From 7 to 9, tune in to Ben Shapiro, your local downtown radio station, KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
Since 1890, Stifel has established itself as one of the nation's leading wealth management and investment banking firms by understanding clients' hopes and dreams, focusing on building and preserving wealth. Simply put, when you achieve your goals, we achieve ours. I'm proud to be a part of Stifel as a financial advisor. This is Susan Eastman, First Vice President Investments. Call today for quality time well spent. 530-244-7199. Again, 530-244-7199.
100 years ago, Simpson University began with a promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with a promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Today, Simpson University continues to provide a Christ-centered education, graduating students with mature and infectious faith, critical competence, and a ready spirit to thrive as servant leaders around the world and at our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Thinking about starting a new career or upskilling for the career you have right now? It's never too late to start at Shasta College. Late start classes and 8-week compressed classes are still available. Reskill for those new jobs that are emerging in Shasta County. Find out today about their veterans programs and free tuition. All of this at Shasta College. Go to shastacollege.edu.
I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
And we co-host Writing Roots.
It's a 10-minute podcast in which we, an author,
and her editor,
cover lessons we've learned about the writing process.
So whether you're an experienced storyteller or still working on that first book,
now is the time to check us out.
Writing Roots is available on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you find your podcasts. And don't forget to always
write selfishly.
Tobacco and Brew, located at 2143 Hilltop Drive, has been an integral part of our community for over 40 years. They have supported the veterans, law enforcement, fire and disaster survivors throughout this whole time. Tobacco and Brew has expanded their walk-in humidor and brought to the North State new lines of fine cigars, pipes, and tobacco products. Additionally, they are offering a pipe bar to try out new tobacco for taste and aroma. Tobacco and Brew is your one-stop shop for any tobacco product and accessories to include lighters, humidors, pouches, and more. Tobacco and Brew, 2143 Hilltop Drive.
Go not to the elves for counsel, for they will say both no and yes. J.R.R. Tolkien.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hole.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Our monster of the day. These can really be true monsters. It's the Fae. Those tricky buggers.
We're talking not only fairies, but elves, pixies, sometimes gnomes are considered Fae. There are a lot of creatures that are vaguely humanoid with a little bit of a magical twist and often have a very druidic nature in their style of magic. So we are calling them as a super category Fae.
With the Fae usually comes an almost human appearance. They have the same general shape. They're a humanoid. But there's something different. There's something magical, mystical about them.
A lot of times they're the people who wield the plant-type magic. So if you go into a Fae kind of realm, they have their own homelands in a way. And they have interesting light. They are associated with interesting kinds of lighting styles and plants-based architecture. Bridges that are made out of vines and life in the trees and that kind of thing. Most of our monsters are going to be either animalistic or way above humans or a dumb version of humans. The Fae tend to be almost equivalent, if not for their longevity. And therefore, they're able to be a little wiser in a lot of respects.
But the definition and the traditions of what Fae are have changed and developed so much over the years. So in the 16th century, you had a philosopher, alchemist, toxicologist named Paracelsus who classified elves and gnomes as spirits of the air. And that's definitely not what we picture today when we think of elves and gnomes.
I think, like our opener quote kind of implied, Tolkien has redefined what elves are for us. Until Tolkien, almost everybody thought of elves as being anywhere between child size to the size of your fist.
Tinkerbell size.
Yeah.
But now we picture elves as tall, elegant, graceful, walking beings because Tolkien redefined the word.
And I think a lot of the references that I hear to elves in my personal life end up coming through Dungeons and Dragons. They have a very Tolkien style of elf, although I do believe in the version I play they're slightly shorter than humans.
It depends on the kind of elf. Going back to EverQuest, which was the first, like, digital version of D&D, this is where I got my definitions of elves. You had the high elves, which were very Tolkien-esque, tall, elegant elves. You had wood elves that were the shorter, more druidic-based elves. And then night elves, which are in D&D drow.
And if you wanted to listen to another episode talking about the character of elves, we did kind of mention this style in our Shoulder Angels episode, which was back in February, where we talked about the id, ego, super ego. A lot of this super ego stuff gets applied to elves. And that's why I am including Vulcans in the elf, mostly in just modern mythology.
They're space elves.
They play basically the same role in the story.
You go back in history, and elves are more like Santa's elves. Small creatures there to help, or Harry Potter's house elves, where they're helpers, they're servants in some kind of way.
But elves aren't the only fae out there. Probably my favorite are the Tinkerbell pixie type elves in the movie Willow. They were called brownies. The little guys that just kind of make mischief. They'll move stuff around and they'll maybe cast little bits of magic here and there, and they can disappear and reappear. They apparently have a huge hankering for cream. They like get drunk off of fresh cream.
So you have your fairies, pixies, brownies. These are very Celtic.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.